This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Lord Master Fauci has made a couple of proclamations that we want to make sure you're aware of. Welcome to Chicago's Morning Answer. Dan and Amy serving as your regional town criers.
Hiri, hiri.
Good news. On the good news front, St. Tony Fauci saying that it's very likely that if you've been vaccinated, you can now hug your mom.
Woohoo! We went over that last weekend because I was mad. Because you know what, Dr. Fauci, guess what? I've been hugging my mom this whole time. And guess what, too? She's not 6 feet under. She's just fine. So I don't know who the heck he thinks he is, but his little act is getting tiresome.
I rather enjoy his micromanagement of my life. On the bad news front, although he agrees with President Biden that some degree of normalcy will return by year's end, it is possible that mask wearing will have to go into 2022. That was the other big proclamation over the last 24, 48 hours from Tony Fauci that needs to spread among the hoi polloi on the countryside. So we wanted to amplify what he had to say. Now, this is an interesting proclamation in that you have a professor from Johns Hopkins University. He's also at Columbia's Bloomberg School of Public Health. This is a guy named Dr. Marty Makary, writing in the Wall Street Journal that with the case drop of 77% in 6 weeks, he believes we'll have herd immunity by April. So we'll have herd immunity by April, according to one medical expert who's just as credentialized as St. Fauci. And yet we're still looking at mask wearing into 2022. It's hard to square the circle there. So here's what we need to do, because we have this problem. We have this dynamic in the American population that is a challenge. The challenge is this. Madness spreads at the magnitude of crowds, while rationality returns only individual by individual. And since we know those afflicted with such madness have a difficult time processing communications that are more than a single word they can repeat or a pithy phrase they can repeat and just spit back at you, think science and data. We need to come up with a word or a pithy phrase that all of us not afflicted with this madness will adorn our masks with, so that suffering from the madness relentlessly are signaled by those not suffering from the madness to help them out of their psychosis. So the question is, what should that word or phrase be? 312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
That's a good question. I refuse to wear a mask outside. There is no way in the world you're going to catch me with wearing one. And I think people now are not buying scarves anymore because they're just wearing their masks to keep warm. So I can't differentiate, Dan, if they're brainwashed, stupid, or just cold. You know what I mean?
Because
I sit there in my bay window and I watch people walk by. I'm like, oh my God, that girl's 3 years old. Why does she have a mask on? And if you can confront them and ask them, sometimes they'll say, well, we just wear this instead of a scarf.
Yeah, but you can't. It needs to be. Remember, Black Lives Matter, science and data, racist, bigot. It needs to be a phrase that these people can just they can't assimilate. They can't have a conversation like you're describing. That's not possible. That doesn't bring them out of their madness. You just need to, pound them with a word or phrase that penetrates the concrete between their ears. I think that's the only way to break that concrete down, that intellectual concrete.
And again, though, I don't know why we're wearing masks. I mean, over the weekend, on Friday, Dr. Awardi was ringing the bell saying, we had the lowest positivity rate we've had in Illinois, in Chicago, since this pandemic began.
Today, In the city of Chicago, we are averaging just 323 new COVID cases per day. That is down from more than 3,000 a day. Down from more than 3,000 a day, just at the peak of a few months ago.
And that is great news, but why are we still wearing masks then?
Nationally, COVID cases are down 77% over the past 6 weeks. It has nothing to do with Allison Ouardi. Dr. Macri writing in the Wall Street Journal, if a medication slashed cases by 77%, we call it a miracle pill. And he goes on to explain his perspective as to the question, why is the number of cases plummeting much faster than experts predicted? And certainly that clown show at City Hall, in large part because natural immunity from prior infection is far more common than can be measured by testing, which is something a lot of people have been saying for many months. Testing capturing 10 to 25% of infections, depending on when during the pandemic someone got the virus. Applying a time-weighted case capture average of 1 in 6.5 to the cumulative 28 million confirmed cases would mean about 55% of Americans have natural immunity. Now add people getting vaccinated, and as of this week, 15%, or last week, 15% of Americans have received the vaccine, and the figure is rising fast. So this is why he says, at the current trajectory, I expect COVID will be mostly gone by April, allowing Americans to resume normal life. So we need to stop asking the question why we should be doing things that we're doing, because we shouldn't be. The question is, how do you bring people out of their psychoses? And, you know, it's just, you can't wear a mask outside that says you're outside, because then you're wearing a mask outside.
Exactly. That's my problem.
I mean, I know you can communicate. So that's what I said. It's just a little bit more challenging. And do you have an outside mask and an inside mask? Do you have masks that apply to different age demographics? So, you know, you have a mask that's directed at parents who are masking up their three-year-old, as you were just describing. Or do you try to come up with a universal message about somebody's illness, mental illness? I don't know. Here's my offering, and then take suggestions. Mine would just be, remember, it's got to be like a word or just a couple of words.
Not an acronym. It's got to be.
You're talking about people who, you know, get lost in the depth of a fortune cookie message. I would say placebo.
Okay.
Placebo. And maybe I would have two masks that say placebo and then, I don't know, amplify, exclamation point on the second mask. I don't know, but placebo is my word. But we need help here, because we have to do this in unison. It can't be mixed messages. It needs to be the stuff that persuades so many of these automatons.
I got one. I think I have one. You're all idiots for wearing one of these.
That's a little lengthy.
It's a little lengthy, but I got a big face, big mouth, you might want to say, and I could cover it up, you know, if I
also
start
think,
under the eyes. And down
I also think name calling is not the best way. I think, you know, you have to make them feel like they're doing something morally superior, because this is the place they're coming from.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Mm-hmm. By the way, Dr. Macri also puts the COVID-19 fatality rate population-wide at about 0.15%, which turns out to be about what the seasonal flu is. Mm-hmm. You know, when all is said and done after the last year and all of the conversations and all of the modeling and all of the apocalyptic predictions about the human carnage were about, and now all the lockdowns and all the destruction that's been wrought by the knee-jerk responses, by make-believers and lockdowners, you're at a population fatality rate about the seasonal flu.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, in retrospect, after the celebrations are over for things that they did not accomplish, one might ask some of these lockdowners, well, was it worth it? How do you justify everything you did when it just brings us back to this place nationwide? And in comparison, and frankly, these lockdown states don't compare favorably to the light touch states of a Florida or a South Dakota.
And all those spreading, I mean, they also try to scare us on a daily basis. The Thanksgiving spread, the Christmas super spreading event, the Super Bowl COVID spreading event, none of those, not one of those happened.
All right, we'll take your calls all morning on this because we have to get this campaign started post-haste. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. You want to get to St. Andrew of COVID-19 in New York and his political future. He had a remarkable press conference on Friday morning to try to dig himself out of the nursing home scandal there.
Sometimes a cover-up is worse than the crime.
But before that, we were working on this campaign for masks. We need to come up with a word or a pithy phrase to signal to those afflicted with the COVID madness that it's okay to start firing your synapses again. It's okay to start thinking again, a way to deprogram them, a way to undo the delusions under which they are suffering, particularly if we're going to be forced to wear masks in so many spaces in so many states well into 2022, as St. Fauci said yesterday, despite the fact that we're projecting some medical experts, including Johns Hopkins doctor writing in the Wall Street Journal, projecting herd immunity will be achieved by April with the trajectory of the drop in COVID cases and a better perhaps understanding now of the percentage of the population that has natural immunity, combined those who with those who have been infected and survived, combined with those who've been vaccinated.
And also, Dan, Dr. Fauci said yesterday, too, that if you had COVID and survived, you don't need two vaccines. You just need one.
That's
just in case a public service announcement for
we'll just create more confusion.
Yeah.
And we're by the way, by the end of this week, we should hear from the FAA an emergency use authorization for the Johnson & Johnson one jab vaccine, the one shot vaccine. So that could come online and perhaps even expedite that April timeline that much more. Take a couple calls. We've gotten suggestions. I suggested placebo. We've got lab rat. We've got sheeple. Again, I don't think leading with the insult is necessarily the best way to go. But let's go to Paulette in Culver, Indiana.
Hi. I have thought about this for quite a while. My husband and I are not mask wearers. We typically don't go into stores that require them. And I thought of using the symbol 666 and my white mask.
It's a little aggressive.
And I also, my husband, my daughter said somebody might get the wrong idea, because the whole point with that is you're not allowed to buy good or receive services unless you have the mark. And my husband came up with the idea of putting a circle around it using the no symbol with the line through it. So that was our take on it, especially since there is treatment for this disease now. So that's where we're at.
All right. Thanks for the call, yeah. Paulette.
Mike Scott had a good one. Freedom doesn't look like this.
That's not bad. Yeah, that's not bad. George in Elk Grove Village.
Good morning. See, I had a couple of mask suggestions, and my first one was borrowed from something else earlier this year, but it was I can't breathe.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had another one. Asphyxia.
Again, with the insults. Yes, okay.
So, but it's kind of funny, masks. I've actually been wearing a Halloween mask in stores for every store that requires it, and nobody's ever called me on it.
Whatever you need to do to get through it, you know?
Thanks for the call, George. Let's go to Keith in Kankakee. Keith, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, good morning. Down here in Kankakee County, there's a sports complex that I play in, my son plays in. I'm not going to mention which sport so Dan doesn't make fun of me, but
soccer.
95% of the people play, or 95% of the people there are not wearing masks. It's great down here. But there's always a family or two wearing masks. It's the entire family. And what approach could be made to say, why are you still wearing a mask? You're 5% of the people in here are wearing. Why are you still doing it?
All right. Thanks for the call,
Keith. It's hard. That's a hard call. I mean, do you approach them or just let them be?
Well, that's what I say. I think the whole like this whole campaign is designed to be subtle and to avoid those sorts of confrontations. You just have to signal, and this is how people receive. We're talking about people largely that have "Hate Has No Home Here" signs in their yards,
right,
that are susceptible to the virtue signaling and the sloganeering of the left. So why not understand how they process information and the limited amount of information they're able or willing to process, and just provide that level of information to them, but with a different, that puts them in a different direction, you see.
And I ran into a crazy person, I told the story last week, who was freaked out that I was walking down the sidewalk without a mask and literally fell into the slopes, into the snow. I just said, why don't you read and catch up on what it's like, why you have to wear a mask outside or what the recommendation is.
Oh, the slopes. Oh, during a blizzard, during the problems. Were you a relative of the Ted Cruz family? The slopes. Wow.
I mean, I feel like it's a mountain of snow. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh,
17
sure.
inches of snow.
Yeah, okay.
He fell into the snowbank is what I meant to say.
Yeah, okay.
Hey, Dan, what happened to your Bane Batman mask? That was very sinister.
I still have it, but that's intended to frighten and or ridicule. And what I'm trying to up my game, elevate it, and work on this deal of trying to bring people back to rationality. I don't know if we'll be successful, but I think we should make a game effort. Is all I'm saying.
You should tweet that picture out again. It's great.
Ruth in Elgin, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Redundant.
Redundant.
Yeah. Okay. Foolish or mindless.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Ruth. Greg in LaGrange.
Hey, good morning. 0 points for creativity, but it's already ingrained in our psyches. What's on your face?
What's in your wallet? What's on your face?
It's not bad. All right. All right. Thanks. Glenn in the South Suburbs.
Yeah, good morning. I think those of us who still have a mind realize that the objective of this government is to change our society to that of one of the Star Trek Borg societies. Therefore, I think we can use either mind control or masking your mind.
Okay, mind control or masking your mind. All right, thanks for the call, Glenn. Appreciate it. We'll continue spitballing this all morning until we settle on something that, really sets the light bulb off for all of us collectively. Then we'll know we have it. But I do want to get to Andrew Cuomo because you had this allegation made by a New York State Assemblyman from Queens named Ron Kim that after he criticized Andrew Cuomo's administration for, through a surrogate, admitting that they purposely withheld information from members of the State Assembly for fear that they would be presenting information that could be incriminating, which is not the best excuse to use in terms of withholding information. And we're talking about the number of deaths at nursing homes in New York as a direct result of Andrew Cuomo's policy of returning COVID-infected patients to nursing homes. When Ron Kim criticized Andrew Cuomo, this is the call he got last week from Andrew Cuomo, and it's leading more Democrats in New York State to use the I word and not in the direction of Trump for a change.
When we get closer to the truth behind the growing nursing home scandal in New York, Governor Cuomo tries to implicate you in the cover-up or threatens your livelihood if you don't lie for him. And that's what happened to me in the last 1 week. I was one of six lawmakers in that private meeting for 2 hours with Secretary DeRosa when she accidentally told us the truth, that there was a cover-up and fear that the information would be weaponized against Governor Cuomo. But that moment, I had to tell the truth, and I had to let the public know what happened. And Governor Cuomo called me the next day at 8 p.m. while I was about to bathe my kids. I was with my wife, and for 10 minutes, he berated me. He yelled at me. He told me that, my career would be over. He's been biting his tongue for months against me. And I had tonight, not tomorrow, tonight, to issue a new statement, essentially asking me to lie and asking me, I heard and I saw a crime the other day. And he's asking me that I did not see that crime.
Oh, boy.
And Cuomo had a press conference on Friday, his press conferences that are Emmy Award winning.
International Emmy Award, which he should hand back, by the way.
Oh, keep it.
Really?
Because it says more about the International Emmy than it does about Cuomo. You go ahead and you keep that award and you enjoy it. This is, you know, full damage control, trying to explain that, you know, the real failure here, it was not a cover-up. It was not being less than forthright. It was not doing anything incriminating. It was not actually not following federal guidance when it came to nursing homes, which there's a memo now out that gives lie to that cover story that he was offering. You know what it was? He was so focused on protecting families of nursing home residents. He was so focused on saving lives that he didn't fight aggressively enough against the misinformation that was being spread. Listen to this guy.
We didn't fight back against the lies and the politics and the distortions aggressively enough. In retrospect, that is true. It is whack-a-mole. It is that Twitter 24 hours a day. It is politicians making up stuff to get their face on TV. I get it.
Sure. Like
but
Chris Cuomo.
You have to knock it down and counter it aggressively. Otherwise, people will believe it. And here, the people who were listening to it were people who were in pain and looking for answers. I was not aggressive enough in knocking down the falsity.
Oh, my God. I mean, he's the victim now. This
but
is what it is.
He wants you to know that he will no longer allow misinformation to be spread that will hurt the families of those who've lost a loved one who died in a nursing home. He's not going to let any misinformation stand. He is going to be aggressive. He is going to make up for not being proactive enough when it came to the misinformation that was being spread. Now, of course, he was the purveyor of the misinformation. He's going to challenge media types and those who seek media platforms to aggrandize themselves to tell the truth. Of course, he was, I mean, this is the great projection. Of course, he was the one doing Q-tip routines with his brother Fredo on CNN.
Who can't cover him now, by the way.
It's just remarkable. I mean, it was a. I watched the entire hour. It was a remarkable press conference, the problem I think he has is that the pliable D.C. / New York press corps may, in substantial part, buy this, but I don't think New Yorkers are buying it, and I think he's in real political trouble, if not legal trouble. Less than AOC. Call for an investigation into Cuomo. So now he's fallen into his own piranha tank and he's trying to claw his way out before there's nothing but bones left. And I don't know that he gets out of that tank.
No, FBI and DOJ in Brooklyn, they're investigating him. And Mayor de Blasio came out and said, yeah, he bullies people all the time. What he did to Kim, he does to a lot of politicians. And Kim is right and Cuomo's wrong. I mean, it's so bad that even Pete Davidson played Governor Cuomo on Saturday Night Live.
That's so lame.
Well, I'm just saying that.
Lame. Whatever. Saturday Night Live, please.
They're not ignoring it.
Well, I understand, but this is the way that the press corps is trying to, and the, you know, the parody press corps, as if there's a difference, trying to present themselves as somehow even-handed. They're not even-handed. They were culpable in everything that Andrew Cuomo did for the last year, and now they're going to pretend to be those who speak truth to power and hold the political class accountable. What a lie. That's the other lie that shouldn't be allowed to advance, speaking of aggressively pursuing misinformation, the idea that the press corps is not as loathsome, is not as indictable for everything that Andrew Cuomo has done over the last year, starting with the policy of returning sick individuals to nursing homes, as Andrew Cuomo himself is, because they are. And that's why we're going to stick on this story and stick on this guy, because there is one political casualty that should be buried as a result of what he did during COVID and buried with his bestseller and his International Emmy along with it. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You've made the switch and it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We need to get to Texas and what happened over the last 10 days there, because the left is already trying to gaslight, pun intended, the American people on the topic of energy delivery, and suggest that Texas was a failure of a go-it-alone attitude, not connected to the federal grid, and so it's a way for them to argue against federalism, argue against subsidiarity, and argue for the centralization of all things in D.C. That's number one. And number two, it wasn't a cause or exacerbated by a market externality and an over-reliance on renewables, or as Jason Isaac over at the Texas Public Policy Foundation describes them, unreliables. It wasn't the unreliable energy, the renewable energy, that didn't exacerbate it. This is actually the reason for the Green New Deal, not an indictment of Green New Deal policies. Want to get to that, but we have this campaign we're trying to conclude today, so I want to take a couple more calls. The word or phrase on masks to signal to those who can only assimilate pithy slogans. That's how they understand the world. That's all they're willing to process in terms of depth of communication. What do we send to them to try to unprogram some of our fellow Americans who've been programmed or addled by COVID fear and propaganda? Jared in West Chicago.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Just wanted to say that love your show, but I was thinking about the word socialism, and I feel like that would not be the right choice, only due to the fact that so many people are very sensitive, and you don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. So mm-hmm. I chose the word forced unity.
Forced unity.
For my mask.
That's good. All right. Thanks for the call, Jared. Yeah, something Orwellian, you know, freedom equals slavery. Maybe that would get some propellers spinning. You're sort of going down that path. I still think I'm the leader in the clubhouse with placebo, but I may be a bit biased in making that assessment. That is not for me to make.
Right.
That is for others to make.
Okay.
Lucy in Lowell, Indiana.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Kind of picking up on what Cuomo was saying, how about capital M-A-S-S, capital K, mask, misinformation? That would kind of cover everything, too, that comes in with the fake media and such. So mask, information, but it's M-A-S-S with a capital K at the end, information.
All right. All right. Thanks for the call, Lucy. Not bad. Marty in Naperville.
Hey, not a saying, but a cool thing I saw at the Tampa airport. Got off the plane. The police officers in Tampa, their masks look exactly like their face because they take a picture of their face and they have their mouth done.
Awesome.
And it looks like they're not wearing a mask at all. And I'm dying to get one of those and wait for somebody to say something to me. The masks look hilarious. They look just like their face.
Thanks for the call, Marty. I want to get one of those like plaster half-face masks like you saw with the assassin in Boardwalk Empire, if anybody saw that show. Yeah.
That'd be
something
good
like that, where you can even like stencil the half a mustache on. Like he hit his face, it was half and half vertical because he was injured in war. But you could, you know, maybe even stencil on some facial hair or something.
Yeah. And speaking of Tampa horizontal. Police officer, I met one who said, you know, what they wanted to defund us, and now they want us to hand out tickets to people who aren't wearing masks.
Did
in
you
certain
say a
parts
Tampa
of Tampa.
Police officer?
Yeah.
Wait a second. You were skiing?
No,
and
I
then
said
you were also
I
was... in Tampa?
I'm a regular Ted Cruz, okay? I get around.
Wow.
Just dropping off the kids. That's all I was doing.
Of course.
But with a rollaway bag. Yeah.
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 Right.
I'll just
be,
dropping
you'll
them
be,
off.
You'll be back for your husband. I got it. Jim in Crown Point.
How about take off your mask? Simon says take off your mask.
Ah, okay.
All right. Mary Ellen in Crete.
Hi, you guys. I thought of got Fauci'd with a question mark.
That's good. Now that's creative.
I know your screener really liked it, too.
Well, if Quinn likes it, I mean, it's got to be good.
I don't know if it's better than placebo, but all right. All right, thanks for the call, Marianne. That's good. Got Fauci'd.
I got Fauci'd?
Yeah, but remember, you're trying to deprogram people, and they genuflect before St. Fauci. So I don't know if that will trigger anything in them. It's hard to know their minds. Elliot in Wilmette.
Hello. It's, what we've got on is a freedom gag.
Freedom gag.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for the call, Elliot. Freedom gag. All right. John in Huntley.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I like the idea of the placebo. I think that's really good. But add like a question mark or an exclamation point or maybe like three ellipses, and it expands the market that way. Depending on how you feel, you can just take one of those masks, and if you want to engage somebody, you can use the ellipses, or if you want to question it, you can put the question mark one on or the one with an exclamation point. That's all.
Oh,
I
that's
got.
Not bad. That's good. Thanks for the call, John. You may put placebo in a quote bubble so that if it could prompt somebody to want to inquire, and then you could have that conversation that maybe would bring them out of their psychoses. Interesting. Tom in Blue Island.
Dan, Amy, good morning. Hey, Dan, try to go easy on Emily Tate later. She's my former next-door neighbor.
Okay.
My word is pinata. In the line of your use of placebo, the same kind of idea. You just get beaten, beaten, beaten until everything just falls out.
Okay. All right. Thanks for the call. Tom, Art in Manhattan. Hi, Art.
Art.
Hey.
Hey. What do you got?
Yeah, I just I have a mask that I bought off Etsy.com in... A woman made it, and they're full of naked breasts.
Mm-hmm.
Double D's,
and
I hope.
Everywhere
full
I
of
go,
naked breasts. Not just two.
They are all real naked breasts of women, and everywhere I go, I get people wanting to take pictures of them, and I've been told many times, you could not wear that in here, and I said, what? It is a mask.
Yeah.
It's a mask.
Did that mask come with the Bikini Inspector t-shirt? Or is that separate?
No, I've already got one of those.
I see.
Got one.
Hey, Art, are you on Twitter? Can you tweet out a picture of that? The mask with the...
No, I was banned from Twitter. I was banned from Twitter.
Bad boy.
That's really shocking to hear.
Amy, you and I are linked in together, though. I might be able to take a picture of it for you there.
Okay. I haven't checked my LinkedIn in a while, but sure, I'll check it out.
This is going to give you motive to do that. I love you guys. You guys are great to listen to in the morning, and... hopefully get up to Geneva and see you guys.
Thanks. All right, thanks for the call, Art. I think...
bring your mask, though.
I bet Art has one of those, ladies' leg lamps.
Oh,
right. Christmas Story.
Yeah.
I bet he has one of those in his home, too.
I gotta check that out.
James Crown Point.
James, yes. Hello, guys. First time texter, first time caller.
All right.
Great.
Three words. What me worry?
Okay, Alfred E. Newman. All right.
You got it.
All right. Thanks for the call, James. Very good. Pat in Lockport.
Yeah, I think it should say face diaper because you're a dumb double or a double S for wearing it.
All right, Pat. That's sort of the sledgehammer approach. Okay. Bob in Hammond, Indiana.
Yes. Good morning. I love listening to your show.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
And I would say this is what freedom looks like.
This is what freedom looks like, but it would be on a mask, so it's not what freedom looks like. Is that supposed to be ironic?
Right, yes.
Oh, okay. All right.
It's supposed to be they're Muslim. They're keeping you from speaking, you know, trying to shut you down.
Right.
Thanks for the call.
Maybe a mask that said, my governor's an idiot. Somebody sent me that when Pritzker kicked me out of the press room. I'm like, oh. People love that mask, but I, out of respect for the office, I don't wear it in public.
The forced unity is something to that. Like maybe with like a picture, have like going across, you know, where your mouth would be, just your mouth sewn shut, mm-hmm. you know, like no dissent or something like that to maybe suggest that this is so un-American. Something maybe even less subtle and more direct that this is... un-American, and it's frankly dangerous.
And European countries are laughing at us that we're doing this.
Well, they are laughing inside glass houses. Ben in Carmel, Indiana.
Hi, love the show. Big-time fan. My phrase is social masturbation. It requires all of us and doesn't accomplish much.
All right, pretty good. if graphic.
Yes.
Is that Chameleon in Yorkville?
That's correct, Dan. Chameleon. They can change colors depending on which way the wind is, political wind is blowing. And I'd also like to comment, Dan, Amy. Dan, you are the Midwest version of Rush Limbaugh.
Oh,
great
well.
Job.
Oh,
thank
look
you.
At that,
thank you
huh?
very much. Appreciate that.
Enough about me. What do you think of me?
I would never accept such a compliment, but I do appreciate it. John in Crown Point.
How about have a Coke and a smile?
I don't think we can do Coke anymore because I think we're still too white. Yes. Too many of us are still too white. Thanks for the call, John. That's
another part
of the new Coke corporate propaganda. So that's a whole other topic area. I don't know if there's a way to blend opposition to critical race theory with opposition to virtue signaling COVID policies, destructive virtue signaling COVID policies, which is actually a bit redundant, which was one of the suggestions that's been made, redundant. Mary in Midway.
Oh, this one wrote itself. This mask is as useless as my governor.
Oh.
All right. Thanks for the call, Mary. Now you got to remember, most of Illinois loves their J.B. Pritzkers.
Oh, how is that possible? Well, it's the same people that are masking up outside when they're walking their dog alone on a street.
And their dog is masked up.
Oh, yes. That's right.
Ed in Glen Ellen.
Well, Mary just shared that my mask is as useless as my governor. And Amy, I actually shared that mask with you back in, I'm not sure when it was, October or whatever.
Who knows?
An event it was an event at the Bolingbrook golf thing. And
yeah.
I was there and shared this mask with you. Anyway, I just said, my mask is as useless as my governor. And it isn't. I got to change it now because, you know, I can clean windows with my mask and I can pick up dog with my mask, and you know, so my mask is actually more useful.
Sure, your mask does have some functionality, unlike your governor.
Exactly, right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Ed. Bob and a lot of Hammond calls. Bob and Hammond.
Hey, morning, guys.
Morning.
I just want to add a word that they like so much: the word science with a question mark on it.
All right. Thanks for the call, Bob. Cherie in Balbo?
Yes, I think the mask should say conformity, and the con part should be in quotation marks, conformity.
Oh,
that's not bad.
That's not bad, yeah.
That's not bad. I like that. Thanks for the call, Cherie. I like conformity, too, it's actually a little bit of a subtle dig.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there's something there. It's not as good as placebo, but there's something there.
It's because it came from you.
That's correct.
Hi.
Mary on the South Side. Go ahead, Mary.
Hey, what about I Can't Breathe?
Yeah, you're the second to offer I
oh,
Can't
I'm
Breathe.
Sorry.
No, that's all right. Well, thanks for the call. It shows that, you know, there's some thinking going on there. There's some people thinking similarly, so that's okay. I got another one, a text, control experiment. I'm the control group.
It's
not bad. It's a little heady, but it's not too bad. Dirk and Stager.
Hi, good morning, guys. How about if I want your opinion, I'll drop the mask mandate.
Oh, that's good.
All right, Dirk.
I got another one on our text line. Wake up with an exclamation point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not bad.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the two categories of Americans, the woke and the awake. Or are they too close? I don't know. Because I hear that phrase now. My friend, she's awake, and this is the opposite of woke. She's like awake to the woke.
Okay.
That makes sense.
It's
a lot of language alterations that have occurred recently. Matt in Palos.
Yeah, mine's a Hotel Moscow, but you can never breathe.
Eagles fan. All right, thanks for the call. Vince in St. Charles.
Where I have nothing to write on the mask, but I'll tell them when they're done with the mask, put it in a paper bag, swing it over your head, and scream like a chicken because I think a jerk like you would do anything wear a mask.
All right, thanks, Vince. Mike in St. Charles.
Gag of rights.
Gag of rights. Not bad.
Good. Got another one on the text line. Oppression.
Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Oh, hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Got a couple of good ones for you. One of them is how's the Kool-Aid? Another one is screw Fauci. And another one is CO2 device or CO2 hazard. Okay, CO2 hazard. But screw Fauci's good, and how's the Kool-Aid today? All right, whatever. All right.
Thanks, Greg. Chris in Lamont. CO2
hazard. Hey, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. I don't have a clever phrase, but my mask is filthy, and I've had it for like 3 months. It's got a cigarette. It's got a cigarette burn on it. It's got ketchup on it.
Ew.
And people just stare at it.
Remind me not to make out with you. Ew.
Yeah,
you got to wash that thing, Chris.
But apparently he doesn't.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, good morning, and I think I've got it.
Okay.
I've got our mask campaign slogan.
Do we need a drum roll?
Well, this is why I lead the messaging session, and we rely on our talented listeners to contribute, because it was starting to form with forced unity, with conformity, and some of the other suggestions from our callers. I think I've got it.
Okay.
It's more simple than even placebo, which is very good. My previous hour.
Thank you, Justin.
The mask slogan to unprogram the COVID cultists is "Don't think, follow."
Ah,
isn't that elegant?
That's perfect. That, you know what, that nails it. Don't think, follow.
Don't think. Period. Follow. Period. I like it. I'm going to get a few hundred made up, and we're going to start distributing them, because
okay. We
this has to be. And maybe we should all like dress like Slim Shady. So it's like a whole group. We all wear blue jeans and a white T-shirt, right, like Eminem back in the day.
Yeah.
So that we're, you know, the whole army of people trying to bring our fellow Americans back to rationality.
Yeah, we can wear them at our event in Lake Geneva in March.
Okay.
March 20th. By the way, we still have tickets. Go to am560.com.
Well, you know, it's not our job to save Western civilization. We're just going to do it.
Good.
That's what we're doing. That's what we're about on this show. Speaking of which, it's also our job to drive home the point of what so many of these even unpaid local politicians, which is what so many of them become when they ascend to the heights of a school board. This rather remarkable Zoom call that featured school board members for Oakley Union Elementary School Board in California. This is what they had to say when they thought their Zoom call was on private. They thought it was. This is what they had to say about parents who were complaining about pedestrian matters like their kids' education.
I honestly don't care about that part, but you know what? Are we alone?
Yeah.
If you're going to call me out, I'm going to f*** you up. Sorry, that's just me.
You know, they forget that there's real people on the other side of those letters that they're writing.
Yes.
We're real community members. We have kids or have known kids that have gone to these schools.
Right.
We have a vested interest in this process, and they don't know what we
right.
do behind the scenes. And it's really unfortunate exactly. that they want to pick on us because
right.
they want their babysitters back.
Right.
Right.
Right. That's how I feel.
I agree, and it's fine. It's just I
totally hear that because my brother had a delivery. Yeah, my brother had a delivery service for medical marijuana. My clientele were parents with their kids in school.
Okay. Uh oh. Laura Lanier, just FYI, you guys have the meeting. Oh, we have the meeting open to the public right now.
Uh-oh.
Oh, no. Uh-oh, is this on?
That's what Laura just said.
Oh, no.
Great.
Oh, boy. Well, what happened when this got out that they think all the parents in their district are potheads who want somebody else to babysit their kid is that all those board members you just heard, the four of them resigned.
Gone. Smart thing to do. But also, one of you know the one board member, who the lovely lady who said, I'm going to blank you up, F you up? She was held to test because one of the parents said, well, you're going to parties all the time during this pandemic, but you won't let our kids go to school. So that's where that came from. That
there's a couple other things. One is this idea, you know, you don't know what we're doing behind the scenes. I'll tell you what.
They're doing nothing.
No. Well, tell me. Tell me what you're doing behind the scenes. What you don't understand what we go through. Communicate it. Is it a secret? You're a school board member. You're an elected official. Tell me everything you're doing and the basis for it. I'm willing to listen. What do you got? Defend your position. You don't get to say, this is my position and you don't understand it, so I'm not going to explain it. No, which is the position they take. They're the aggrieved party. They're the besieged party. I'm doing so much. You just don't see it. You don't understand it. Well, lay it bare for all to see. We're here. You got an audience. That's number one. Number two, the whole babysitter thing. Good observation from Brown University's Emily Oster. School is serving two roles. It is a child care solution, and it is teaching people to learn. The idea of, you know, we're not babysitters. Actually, you are in part, and there's nothing wrong with that. She goes on to say, I found it a little disrespectful to people. What's wrong with having part of your job be child care? That's a totally reasonable job. But the other thing is, it's not really fair to say to parents, can't you take care of your own kid? When you told me I have to put my kid in school 8 hours a day, that's the law. It's a law that my kid has to be in school. And now you're telling me that the expectation should also be that I'm free for all that time, even though I'm legally required to not have my kid here. So it's odd that we've set up this whole system in which people are required to go to school. And then we're to be like, well, school's not your child care. Actually, you told me it has to be my child care under force of law, didn't you? It's a great point she brings up. But that is the affliction of those who believe they are on some pedestal because they are your temporary representative. And you see it manifest itself, obviously, at the highest levels of public office. But again, if you pay attention to what's going on in your village or your school district, you will find that same
attitude.
Absolutely. You will find that same attitude and some of that same behavior. Not everywhere and not by all the members, but you'll find it too often present.
A lot of them and this think is they're why, God. And, I can't stand it.
This is why there's a disconnect. This is why there's a disconnect between what you think is happening and what is actually happening. Who you thought was in control of your kid's education and who actually is. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Emily Erickson. She is in Geneva 304 School District, and she's part of the Get Back to School campaign out Western Suburban Way. Emily, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, thanks for having me, Dan and Amy. I'm a longtime listener.
Oh, great. Well, good. It's a pleasure to have you. So tell us about Get Back to School in the Geneva School District. I thought the kids were back to school.
Yeah. Actually, we were presented in the beginning of the year with a hybrid schedule, meaning that, you know, our kids were going to school 2 days a week and then alternating every other Friday. At the beginning of the year, we were proud. We were, you know, excited and almost in disbelief that we were one of the few schools that had a portion of our school in-person learning. And then enter the middle of the year after we had like this adaptive pause that the state had granted a few days, that the district came in and said, the teachers need some extra planning. We're going to have half day at home synchronous learning temporarily. And then the second half of the day would be time for the teachers to, you know, have extra planning time, et cetera. We accepted it. No problem. All right, we'll go with the flow. We want to be easygoing. And then come December, the board met, and January 11th, they announced that going forward, Fridays would now no longer be in person, and we would be at home doing synchronous learning for the remainder of the year. Well, that was basically the wake-up call and got us parents motivated and moving to say, this is not acceptable anymore. We can't sit back and be quiet. We need some answers. We need a plan. We need to get our kids back in school.
Well, Emily, how are you guys fighting back? What are you doing?
Many things at this point. Basically, we're urging people. We have kind of a core group of parents that are organizing, you know, an ever-growing group of parents and community members to reach out to the board. We're asking them to, you know, write letters to both the board members, our city officials, state representatives, the governor. We're hosting actually a rally before our board meeting tonight from 5:30 to 6:30, urging parents to come out and support the movement to get our kids back in school. Kind of a crazy concept, right?
You know, I mean, this is not particular to you, but it obviously includes you in Geneva 304. You know, you're also 6 weeks from an election. Local elections. And so everything that's transpired over the last year, you would think people would pay perhaps more attention to their municipal elections, which include school boards, and maybe field some candidates if you don't like the representation you're getting from your current school board.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that, you know, unfortunately, we're a little late to the game, everybody getting riled up. And we have since had a lot of people say that, even though it's closed, to get yourself on the ballot, you know, whether or not you try to get a write-in ballot or if not this election, I know we are definitely going to have a lot of parents interested come the next election.
And you have a first grader and a fourth grader. How are your kids doing?
You know, it's interesting. It's changed throughout all this. My first grader, I think all kids at the end of last year were like, ooh, this is fun. We're at vacation. But that novelty slowly wore off. And in the beginning of the year, my daughter struggled just a little bit, just throwing temper tantrums. She's the first grader. I don't want to work. You know, I don't want to do this. And, you know, it was the argument back and forth. Well, I'm not assigning this to you, and you have to do this. Would you act this way to your teacher? Yada, yada. You know, the same thing so many parents are going through. She has since turned around. She's doing fairly well. My son, on the other hand, struggles. You know, it's a constant fight to get him to focus, pay attention, stay on track. It's a nightmare. I mean, the dynamic in the house and in so many households are just, they're destroying our kids.
And so, by the way, no less a canonized member of the left than Andrew Cuomo said on Friday, students deserve in-class teaching.
He repeated that.
Students deserve in-class teaching. This is the new mantra of so many on the left who are under siege. And I wonder what the response has been to that position, which I think you take and many parents who are part of this Get Back to School movement out Geneva way take. What's been the response from the superintendent and the school board?
You know, I think the silence that we've gotten from them is the most frustrating part, and it makes us question what is really going on. Basically, all we're trying to do is urge them to have a clear and open and frequent communication with the public, define a plan, tell us what the roadblocks are, and, you know, how they're addressing them and how long it will take to resolve them. We want our Fridays back. You know, we want an option for a 5-day in-person learning this year. And at the end of the day, all we're asking them is to fulfill the obligations that they're sworn under oath to do, you know, and that's to provide a quality education in a learning environment that promotes, you know, a personal development and academic skills. And at this point, e-learning is not providing that.
Are you sure you and your friends aren't just a bunch of potheads who want somebody else to babysit your kids?
Well, you know, we were on social media called a bunch of crazy moms, and that just kind of made us all laugh and motivate a little bit more. If wanting to get our kids, you know, a good education and back in school is crazy, then, you know, call me crazy. I don't care. You know, at this point, as we're able to get our word spread, you know, we're trying to reach beyond just our, you know, individual friends and you know, community members. It's picking up exponentially, and we're hoping to have a really strong presence tonight at the board meeting. And I know that they're hearing us. I know that they're hearing us and they're listening. Some of the board members are in support of at least, the very least, trying to get our youngest learners, K-5, back to school and break our unit district model. But for some reason, that concept is being squashed, and it's unacceptable at this point.
And the protest you're having tonight, 5:30 to 6:30, where is it?
This is at the Geneva Administration Building, which is located at 227 North 4th Street in Geneva. Again, that's just prior to the meeting. And then after that, we urge anybody who's comfortable to get up and speak and tell the board their thoughts.
She is Emily Erickson, Geneva 304 School District out in the Western Burbs, Get Back to School campaign that she was describing. Parents are launching, and hopefully perhaps some of those school board members that privately support you will just demonstrate the courage to publicly state their position, which is what is needed in these times. Emily Erickson, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, and we were able to obtain some exclusive audio of the chatter between that United Airlines pilot who's lost his engine over Denver and air traffic control. It's pretty interesting. Here's the back and forth.
Murdoch, the damn lever just came off of my hand, and we're still at war.
Try another lever.
There are no more levers, just switches.
No buttons?
No, no buttons, just switches, lights, and knobs.
Oh, cut the bleeding heart crap, will ya? We've all got our switches, lights, and knobs to deal with, Stryker. I mean, down here, there are literally hundreds and thousands of blinking, beeping, and flashing lights. Blinking and beeping and flashing. They're flashing and they're beeping. I can't stand it anymore. They're blinking and beeping and flashing. Why doesn't somebody pull the plug,
sir?
I'm all right. I'm all right. All right, Stryker.
Yeah, there was. I didn't know that Shatner had decided to go work as an air traffic controller after he retired from acting. No, actually, though, the United Airlines pilot. This is actually pretty cool to listen to.
Very calm and collected.
Yeah, and
why I'm not a pilot, by the way.
Did a great job.
Mayday, Mayday, United 28, United 328 heavy, Mayday, Mayday aircraft.
328 heavy. Say again, please. Read all that again.
Yeah, United Denver departure, United 328 heavy, Mayday aircraft just experienced a engine failure. Need a turn immediately.
328 heavy, left or right turn?
Left turn.
328 heavy, turn left heading 080.
Left heading 080, United 328 heavy.
Second wing 17 left, officer's current, Denver altimeter 2967.
That's just 19 uniform, turn left heading 050.
As of our approach, 109 Charlie Alpha, 14,000 descending via the Dunn 3. Any chance we could go direct to the airport?
Heck yeah.
Yeah, you know, because we lost an engine.
Yeah, do you mind? And pieces are falling from the sky.
So I know they're looking at the 777s now, but it was a great job by that pilot.
Oh, it gives me the chills, that's for sure.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And I, for one, need Joe Biden's riff on China policy translated. This is what he offered with Gloria Vanderbilt's kid at his town hall last week. Joe Biden on China.
It has always been the time when China has been victimized by the outer world is when they haven't been unified at home. So the central, to vastly overstate it, the central principle of Xi Jinping is that there must be a united, tightly controlled China. And he uses his rationale for the things he does based on that. I point out to him, no American president can be sustained as a president if he doesn't reflect the values of the United States. And so the idea I'm not going to speak out against what he's doing in Hong Kong, what he's doing with the Uyghurs in western mountains of China and Taiwan trying to end the one China policy by making it forceful. I said, and by the way, he said he gets it. Culturally, there are different norms at each country, and their leaders are expected to follow. But my point was that when I came back from meeting with him and traveling 17,000 miles with him when I was vice president, he was the vice president. That's how I got to know him so well, at the request of President Hu, not a joke, his predecessor, President Hu, and President Obama wanted us to get to know one another because he was going to be the president. And I came back and said they're going to end their one child policy because they're so xenophobic they won't let anybody else in, and more people are retired than working. How can they sustain economic growth when more people are retired.
What a hot mess. Oh, my God.
So I appreciate that President Biden resisted the temptation to do an Abbott and Costello routine in referencing previous president who. I mean, what's
on second?
It's not a joke. Was anybody taking it as a joke? But it seems to me his position is, you know, we both have to do our performance art. I recite the standard talking points from the American perspective, and you recite the standard points from the Chinese communist perspective, and you go about your business and we go about ours. That's been the approach pre-Trump to China for the better part of five decades. Well, that approach hasn't worked other than to aggrandize China, and I'm very interested to hear how concerned Joe Biden is about President Xi maintaining at least a facade of unity in China as its dictator. I mean, it's just a bizarre, rambling, to me, nonsensical word dump in lieu of an actual particular policy with respect to Chinese expansionism, which he recognized. In his remarks, he recognized China is expansionist. It wants to be the unitary global power, but he doesn't seem to have any particular idea what to do about that. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano for our weekly conversation. He is the VP of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation, author of books including Wiki at War and Private Sector Public Wars. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, good to be with you.
So your translation of what President Biden had to say about China, for starters.
Well, you know, it reminded me of actually Donald Trump's first press conference on Russia. And I love the words hot mess, because that was exactly what everybody took away from that. It's you're supposed to explain to us what you're doing, and it's completely unclear. And, you know, what we found is after Trump's incredibly disastrous press conference, his Russia policy was actually incredibly strong, and a lot of the stability in Western Europe the last 4 years is attributable to that. I don't know if you can make what Biden's what his policy is on this. You know, a friend of mine described it as we're getting the dance of the seven veils. What it sounds like, you know, trying to just parse everything and read the tea leaves, is they want to follow the playbook under Obama, which was, we need to look for areas to cooperate, and, you know, and if we have to challenge them, we will. Well, the problem with that policy, if that is indeed the policy we're going back to, is on every area of crucial interest to the U.S., China's on the opposite side. So you're going to cooperate on what? Things that are meaningless? And if you're going to challenge China, if you don't overtly challenge them, they, and the rest of the world, by the way, actually see that as acquiescing to China. That's how we got where we were in the South China Sea. So they're a bit kind of all over the place. You know, they ran some thought ups, these you know, freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea, which is great. They didn't say much about it, which is bad. They've made reassurances on Taiwan and complaints about Taiwan, which is great. They didn't promote that, which is bad. They've actually put out statements on Hong Kong. They put out statements on the Uyghur, but they put out statements on Burma. But they still haven't responded to Burma yet, and the coup by the generals, and Burma's a client state of China. We've designated the Uyghur activities by China as a genocide. That's an official U.S. policy. The President of the United States said he's not going to talk about genocide, which is shocking, and this government still hasn't done anything about the genocide designation. So all I can reflect on is for a guy who ran for president and was just bemoaning the fact that Trump was coddling dictators, which he wasn't, that speech to the American people, that, you know, conversation to the American people, kind of sounded like he was coddling dictators, and it wasn't a meeting at the United Nations. It wasn't a meeting with the State Department. It was a town hall with the American people, telling him what you're doing with the greatest foreign policy challenge of this generation, and you basically gave them kind of oatmeal.
Yeah, he muddled the message. But is the goal to be friends with China or to dominate them?
Well, this is the problem. This notion of we need to figure out a way to have a balanced relationship with China, that's nonsense. We tried that for decades, and it utterly failed. We have to triage China, which means that we have to prioritize protecting our interests from China. And we didn't get a sense of that in the speech, and that's unfortunate.
So here's the thing. A podcaster that I listen to sometimes reminded me of these facts, which is really helpful because, you know, so much of this, the media has no institutional memory. Most of the political class doesn't either. I know you do. And so the question is, you know, where is China trying to exploit the United States right now? He reminded me. In 2010, the Department of Defense found thousands of its computer servers sending military network data to China, the result of code hidden in chips that handled the machine's startup process. That's in 2010. In 2014, Intel discovered that an elite Chinese hacking group breached its network through a single server that downloaded malware from a supplier's update site. And in 2015, the FBI warned multiple companies that Chinese operatives had concealed an extra chip loaded with backdoor code in one manufacturer's servers. And so, you know, we talk about things like intellectual piracy in present day. Well, you know, we're focused on intellectual piracy when that has been going on for eons. Now, perhaps because we haven't sufficiently addressed it, I understand that. But it also precludes some of us, I think, from thinking in real time and prospectively of what China's next gambit with respect to compromising America is. And one suggestion, as they're trying to fashion themselves a white knight around the developing world by distributing their version of the COVID vaccine, is that it would be something with respect to vaccine distribution or vaccine coding, even with respect to some of the big pharma vaccine producers. And that could be compromised in some material way, biological warfare. What do you have to say about sort of that whole 10-year perspective bringing us to present?
Well, look, all you have to do is actually read what the Chinese said. And for many years, they've said that they plan on, you know, we talked about nuclear weapons being the ultimate instrument. They plan on being the world's information superpower and sucking up all the world's information. And then through the combination of artificial intelligence and quantum computing, essentially being to manipulate that information to do everything they want, which is you use your imagination and the range of activities. And the Chinese are not close to any of that, and there's nothing ethically or morally or legally that prevents them from exploiting that information in any way possible. That, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when we read that stuff, that was an aspiration. Today, these are operational capabilities that we're putting in place, and which gets, I think, back to the point of the whole conversation is China is a present danger. And what we're not hearing from the President of the United States is how China is a present danger. And I get that it's a new team, they're on board, they're focusing on domestic policy and everything else. But leaving the impression of we don't have a plan for China, that just makes the entire world nervous, and it helps the Chinese out a lot. Look, so the president famously just gave a speech at the Munich Security Conference, and he said, I want to work with Europe on China. You know what Europe said? No thanks.
Yeah, well,
I would be hitting the panic button at this point, you know?
It's something. So another enemy of the United States that perhaps is making the rest of the world nervous in terms of the Biden approach, Iran. And the Biden administration says it wants to return to the 2015 nuclear deal and then negotiate a follow-on agreement. One problem, a la Europe with respect to China. Iran doesn't want to. Iran just wants to go to the 2015 deal and, you know, get their $5 billion in IMF loans unfrozen.
And again, you know, the administration is kind of leading with concessions. You know, lifting the terrorist designation on the Houthis and cutting off aid to Saudi Arabia, that's giving a sweetener to Iran. And but this is the problem, I think, this is the administration's tendency, which is to follow the kind of Obama playbook, which is this, let's lead by, showing our friendly face to these adversaries. I under Obama, people interpreted that as weakness, and they took advantage of us. And, you know, essentially you're going back to a failed playbook. I mean, that's what we see so far. Even Russia, where the administration came into office, and the first thing they did was castigate, Trump about the failure to respond to SolarWinds, and and we're still putting the package together of how we're going to respond on solar winds. I mean, this would be like, you know, Pearl Harbor happening on December 8th, and in February, the President of the United States says, you know, we're still putting a process together. So they've got all these processes ongoing and everything, and they're doing all this backdoor brilliant diplomacy. But it just sounds, it's just terribly out of tune for the world in which we are. I mean, you hate Trump, fine, hate the orange hair, hate the tweeting and everything else. You know, he led with a sledgehammer, but that got the China's attention, Iran's attention, North Korea's attention, Russia's attention. I mean, the Biden team so far is kind of flicking, you know, their fingers at guys who are throwing sledgehammers. And you know, maybe they're brilliant, and we just don't give them all enough credit for their brilliance. But but they didn't work before, and I haven't seen any early signs that it's going to work now.
He is Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, Vice President of the Catherine and Shelby Cullen Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Jim, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Remember when we talked about House Bill 3653 in Illinois? People are like, oh, well, Pritzker will never sign that. Well, he's signing it today. This is the basically to put Illinois on the path to abolition of police. Reimagining police at minimum, right. You know, mandating the use of body cameras, requiring the maintenance of police misconduct records.
No chokeholds.
No cash bail. Right. Allowing certain criminal offenders to be set free without waiting in jail for their court date. Eliminate qualified immunity for individual police departments. Prohibit police departments from purchasing certain what they term military equipment like 50 cal rifles. Increased protections for whistleblowers, adding rights for detainees beyond the rights that a detainee already has, more reporting on deaths in police custody, predicate offense for resisting arrest would be required, and so on and so forth.
Well, it gives more rights to the criminals than it does to police officers.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. That's the problem. He's going to sign it today at noon at Chicago State University on the fourth floor, and then go on to Carbondale and Springfield. Because, you know, guys, he's up for re-election. The primary is March 22nd, so we're getting close to that.
Yeah, I don't think he has much of a worry about the primary. And frankly, I don't think he has much of a worry about the general election. Some of my friends deciding to run for governor, notwithstanding. And this should be instructive to people who think he does have some sort of problem in the general election. He is happy to stand on the opposite side of the line from law enforcement in a city that is overrun by violent crime, for example. Just talking about Chicago, and it's certainly not limited to Chicago. A lot of other mid-sized urban centers around Chicagoland and around the state have crime problems too. But understand the ideological disposition of your Illinois Democrat Socialist Party. And it's not limited to Chicago. And it's not limited to the governor's office. Back in June of last year, Trevor Noah, that deep thinker who hosts The Daily Show, had a roundtable on Black Lives Matter and abolishing police. Listen to what some of the offerings were, and I'll explain to you why you're listening to that. It's not just the legislation being signed by Pritzker today. This is Alex Vitale, who is a sociology professor at Brooklyn University, and he has written a book about abolishing the police.
It's really more about a process driven by a set of principles than it is some predetermined outcome. I think what we're seeing on the streets today when people say defund the police, yes, it's about these immediate changes that Patrice is talking about, but it's also about a generation of young people, you know, crying out for a world that isn't driven by racial and class inequalities that are enforced by policing. And the sad truth is that that has been the role that police have played in American society, and enforcers of systems that produce these inequalities. And every time we turn a problem over to them, it makes those inequalities worse in the long run. Mm-hmm. So police abolition is about trying to reduce the burden of policing today while we work to build something better for the future.
Yeah, and let me translate that for you directly with the help of Michael Denzel Smith, who's an author, who's part of that roundtable discussion on The Daily Show.
What does that mean? We say abolish the police because we mean abolish the police, right? there's no mincing of language there. There's nothing that we're trying to trick you on. But the thing I think that where I've come down is just like, who's making the positive argument for the police at this point? And I say that because tell me something right now that the police are good at other than whooping ass.
Why do I play those two bites from that Daily Show episode? Because Rebecca Stewart, who is the assistant principal for instruction at Maine East High School.
Yeah.
Maine East High School. In
where Harrison Ford went. Yes.
The Tony suburbs in Park Ridge.
Mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton.
Linked to self-certification form, Black History Month activities for Monday, February 8th. Watch. Linked, what does it mean to defund and abolish police? The Daily Social Distancing Show with Trevor Noah. So that's what the staff and teachers at Maine East High School were tasked to watch, including the clips you just heard, to inform their certification, whatever, you know, sort of race-conscious certification they're having to get at Maine East High School, and also their understanding of this issue. And perhaps even the facilitation they do with discussing these issues among their high school students at Maine East. Not just a Chicago problem, not just a gubernatorial problem, a cultural problem that has permeated every place in America, including those alleged good schools in the leafy suburbs. That's why it's relevant. And so the signing of the legislation today should surprise no one, because so much territory has been ceded to those two gentlemen you heard from and to identitarian political hacks like Triple Threat and like Jelly Belly.
Just undermines our public safety.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The Purge, Eastside Community School in New York, sent this to white parents, Tool for Action, which tells them they must become white traitors, quote-unquote, and then advocate for full white abolition, quote-unquote. This is, as Chris Rufo, who's been on this critical race theory stuff, like a few others, maybe James Lindsay along with him. This is the new language of public education, and what you find in public education, you quickly find in C-suites in corporate America. The white identity dial, if you will, goes all the way from white supremacist on the one end to white abolitionist on the other. White traitor is what you must become right before you graduate into the sanctified space of white abolitionist. The white traitor actively refuses complicity, names what's going on. Intention is to subvert white authority and tell the truth at whatever the cost. Need them to dismantle institutions. And then the white abolitionist, the truly woke, changes institutions, dismantling whiteness and not allowing whiteness to reassert itself. This is the scholarship, that's also in quotation marks, of these race hustlers that have permeated every civic and cultural institution in America. So how does that manifest itself in corporate America? This PowerPoint from a whistleblower at Coca-Cola that compels employees to be less white. What is all this whiteness? What does it mean? What does it mean to be white? And what does it mean to be less white? They've got a slide for that. The Coca-Cola PowerPoint. To be less white is to be less oppressive, be less arrogant, be less certain, be less defensive, be less ignorant, be more humble, listen, believe, break with apathy, break with white solidarity. That must be a comfortable place to be a employee who happens to be white, Coca-Cola. And that's the case everywhere. Disney made headlines again over the weekend, because they have a disclaimer connected to their offering of old episodes of The Muppet Show.
Yeah, they streamed 5 series, and they think that Kermit the Frog, Fozzie Bear, and Miss Piggy, they contain offensive content.
The disclaimer reads, this program includes negative depictions and or mistreatment of people or cultures. These stereotypes were wrong then and are wrong now. Rather than remove this content, we want to acknowledge its harmful impact, learn from it, and spark conversation to create a more inclusive future together. Yes, there needs to be a future in America where puppets are inclusive.
I mean, the warning is believed to refer to the Muppet characters that are stereotypes of Native Americans, Arabs, and East Asians. Uh-huh. What about the Swedish chef, huh? Are we offended? No.
Right, but this is about dismantling whiteness, and of right. course the Swedish chef represents whiteness, so there's okay to sort of parody in a hyperbolic fashion his Swedish representation, I suppose.
As a dumb Swede, yeah.
If you haven't experienced it yet, or you're someone you know, your child in school, your husband or wife at work, You will. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by our next guest here. He is Stephen Sokup, the senior commentator. He's a senior commentator, vice president, and publisher of The Political Forum. He has a book out, The Dictatorship of Woke Capital, How Political Correctness Captured Big Business, Coca-Cola, perhaps a case study. Stephen Sokup, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, you have written about the incidents regarding The Muppet Show or Coca-Cola come as no surprise to you, I'm certain.
No, they don't. Politically correct action against American consumers and employees has been going on for quite some time.
Well, so where does it go? I mean, there have been some backlashes in some of these, within some of these institutions. For example, you have Title IX cases at the collegiate level that where now the person or the group being discriminated against are men or white people, and they're using Title IX to sort of give those who are race and gender obsessed a little bit of taste of their own medicine when it comes to discrimination by category. Is there any backlash going on in corporate America pretty much corporate America? And if there isn't, what form could it take?
Well, unfortunately, corporate America is moving the opposite direction. Not only is there not any significant backlash. In fact, corporate America is moving further and further into a more practical and effective use of what we would call woke capital to effect change within the global community. So it's actually moving in the opposite direction.
And where does it end, do you think?
Well, it's hard to say at this point. In my book, The Dictatorship of Woke Capital, I identify three forms of pressure on corporate America. One is from the bottom up, which is employees, woke employees who insist that their companies behave a certain way. A second is from the top down, which I think you're seeing from Coca-Cola and Disney over the weekend, which is that the people who occupy leadership positions are pressuring the company to be more overtly politically correct. And the third, which is the primary focus of the book, is from the outside in, which is all of the pressure coming from outside of these corporations to force them to behave in a certain way, to force them to adopt certain moral principles, to force them to behave so that they can achieve different social ends as opposed to their traditional business ends.
And over the past 2 years, though, what politicians, if any, have come forward to, sense that something's wrong with American business?
Well, the first indication that politicians were on the right were beginning to grasp what is going on was about 2 years ago when Georgia passed a fetal heartbeat law. You know, the elected representatives of a center-right state passed a law, and the Republican governor signed the law. So the democratic process worked, and a number of large corporations, particularly within the entertainment industry and led, in fact, by Disney, decided that that was not something they wanted to tolerate. Over the past two decades, Georgia has invested heavily in attracting entertainment companies to the state. More than 100,000 normal, average, ordinary Georgians work in the entertainment industry that it has set up camp in Georgia. And because these large corporations decided that they did not want for Georgia to pass a democratically passed bill on abortion, they threatened all of these jobs, and they threatened to pull their business out of Georgia. And so a number of Republican legislators took notice at that point and said, hey, you know, wait a minute. This is corporate bullying, and it is corporate bullying that is going to impact normal, regular people. The first person to make much of a big deal about this was Senator Cotton from Arkansas, who took to the floor of the Senate to rail against these companies, particularly Disney, who were trying to impose their political beliefs on the people of Georgia.
How much of this is the big tech tail wagging the Fortune 1000's? You know, what bragging the Fortune 1000 dog? In other words, you see Facebook and Twitter being more aggressive, YouTube and Google, obviously, as well, being more aggressive with censorship. And how much of that is saying, well, you know, these are the cultural mavens and we need access to their communication channels. We don't want to run afoul of, you know, their political mores. And so we're going to essentially follow the corporate culture of those big tech companies.
Well, a lot of it is in fact, as you say, being directed by big tech, but a lot of it is also coming from the finance industry.
Yeah.
If you look at, for example, BlackRock, which is the largest asset management firm in the world with almost $9 trillion in assets under management, for the past 2 years, its CEO, Larry Fink, has sent a letter to clients and to CEOs telling them that their primary responsibility will be to focus on sustainability, which is code for climate change, as their primary investment guidance. And so they expect for all companies to disclose any and all possible information about what they're doing with respect to climate change and how they're building their businesses around climate change and how they're preparing for this, you know, to prevent this catastrophe. And if they do not cooperate with what BlackRock demands, then BlackRock will use its leverage to change boards of directors, to change management, to change the bylaws of the corporations. BlackRock has an enormous amount of influence, and together with the other two large passive investment firms, State Street and Vanguard, it can essentially impose its will on corporations, and that's what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, this is one big blob, and it's, so one institution or sector leader, essentially serves the other. They sort of meld all together, and that includes, we can't leave out the federal government. The the Biden nominee for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, a gentleman named Rohit Chopra, who is a Elizabeth Warren protege, has come up with an idea too. A paper he authored a couple of years ago for a think tank, for a public integrity protection agency. The director would serve for 10 years, subject to removal proceedings similar to that of a federal judge. So basically, like they envision for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, untouchable by the elected branches. And it would regulate political activities, restrictions on advocacy, declaring that, for example, the use of think tanks and other nonprofit organizations to further the economic interests of its benefactors through policy research should be impermissible. And it would look at issue-based nonprofits, progressive or conservative, to identify whether they're advancing someone's interests, which, of course, they always are. And if they are, then they could be subject to federal regulation. So you have that culture coming potentially from the federal government. I mean, that's just an idea form right now, but it gives you an insight into the perspective and the mind's eye of these regulators at the highest levels of the federal government, combined with what you're getting from some of the most powerful CEOs in finance and tech. And you know, it sort of goes back to the question I asked previously. How does this all end other than badly, like in some sort of Chinese communist authoritarian form of societal organization?
Well, I certainly think we're moving to a more authoritarian state. And that's the point of all of this is in the book, I trace the history of the anti-democratic nature of administration, both public administration and business administration, over the last probably century and a half, to arrive at the point today where we have not just government, but as you say, big tech and big finance and big entertainment all intending to do big things, to change the way the world works, and to go around the people in order to do so. That's the whole nature of this, is it's anti-democratic. It is intended to usurp the power of the people and to impose these political beliefs from the top down against the will of the people. So it's authoritarian by nature. I think before we end up in a totalitarian type state, however, we'll probably see a natural backlash in the finance community where, you know, any type of investment that misallocates capital eventually creates a problem. And allocating capital specifically based on social goals is clearly a misallocation of capital, and it will eventually cause problems.
Will that backlash be big enough and soon enough is the question.
Well, I think the backlash will be big enough and it will be soon enough, but unfortunately it's going to cost a lot of ordinary people a lot of money. When I say BlackRock has $9 trillion in assets under management that they're leveraging, that money isn't Larry Fink's. That money isn't BlackRock's. That money is yours and mine and everybody who invests or has a 401k or an IRA. So I think that there are hard times coming, but eventually I think there will be a backlash against this. The question is just going to be how much will it cost us?
He is Stephen Sokup, senior commentator, vice president, and publisher of The Political Forum. Check out his new book, The Dictatorship of Woke Capital, How Political Correctness Captured Big Business. Stephen Sokup, thanks for joining us. Good luck with the book.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
We have proclamations, new proclamations from Lord Master Tony Fauci, a couple that present some good news and some potentially challenging news, depending on your perspective on masks, I suppose. The good news, Amy, is
yes.
That if you've been vaccinated, you can now hug your mom. That's the good
yes.
news.
Mm-hmm. I was so excited. Yeah, we played that last week, and I went, oh, really? I'm still hugging my mom, and I'm still hugging my children, too. I don't need Dr. Fauci, who hasn't seen a patient in, 40 years, to tell me this.
I actually prefer, I don't really handle my family relations so well, so I appreciate Dr. Fauci coming in and handling them for me.
Oh, yeah, here he is.
If you're vaccinated and you have a member of your family vaccinated, someone that's not lived with you, can I sit down and give them a hug and things like that? And the answer is very likely, of course you can.
Oh, thank God.
That's fantastic news. That's a real breakthrough in combating COVID and getting back to some normalcy. Now, the less positive news comes yesterday. Tony Fauci on CNN, of course, with Dana Bash fielding softballs and suggesting that, he definitely agrees with President Biden that we should be back to something resembling normalcy, as however it's been redefined or will be by then, by the end of this year. However, he is very possible. He could conceive a situation where we would not stop wearing masks until well into 2022, which is sort of an odd perspective considering, at least according to Dr. Marty Makary at Johns Hopkins and Columbia's Bloomberg School of Public Health, per the 77% drop in COVID cases over the last 6 weeks, we're tracking for herd immunity by April, is what he wrote.
Not July or not by next Christmas?
So again, the need to continue to abide all of the newly minted protocols for dealing with the pandemic, even after the combination of natural immunity, infection and survivors of the infection, and the vaccinated, essentially make the virus de minimis in terms of its public health impact. It's very, very confusing. So to help us try to get some clarity, we're pleased to be joined again by our friend Dr. Joel Zinberg. He's a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute in D.C. and an associate clinical professor of surgery at the Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. Dr. Zinberg, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome. Good morning.
Good morning. So the mask wearing that will go into 2022 potentially, even as you have respected public health professionals just as credentialed as St. Fauci, who are saying we're tracking for herd immunity early spring.
Well, look, I think I've written multiple times in over the past few months that I think we're headed for herd immunity earlier than Dr. Fauci had indicated, because you get to herd immunity when people can resist the transmission of the virus, and that's either because they've been naturally infected and they are now immune, or because they've received the vaccine. And the CDC and others have indicated that far more people have been actually infected than we have confirmed cases, maybe eight times as many. So if we have 25 to 30 million confirmed cases and you multiply that by eight, you're talking about most of the population has already been exposed and probably immune. So you don't need to vaccinate the entire population to get there. So I think we are probably looking at sometime this spring reaching the approximately 70%, 75% of the population having immunity that's necessary to stop the transmission of the virus.
And then Dr. Fauci said yesterday, if you did have COVID, you need one vaccine instead of two vaccines.
Well, I did not hear of Dr. Fauci's comments, so I can't respond specifically, but we've known for quite a while now that you get a fair amount of benefit from just a single vaccine. And here we're talking about the vaccines from Moderna and Pfizer that are two-dose regimen. But we do know you get a good benefit from that, and that's been confirmed in multiple places already. But to get the full benefit, the 95% effectiveness in stopping you from getting COVID disease, you need to get both doses.
So is there a scientific reason why, after herd immunity is achieved, you would still abide mask wearing and 6 feet apart and so forth?
Well, probably not. You'll have to see. You'll have to keep track of how the case counts go and whether they continue to fall. But, every year we have a flu epidemic, and we manage to get through it without widespread social distancing, without mask wearing, because we ultimately reach herd immunity. Between people who get infected and between the number of people who get vaccinated and the natural, course of the virus that sort of peters out, we managed to do it without these mitigation measures. I mean, to be safe, you should continue mask wearing until it's sort of all clear. It's uncomfortable a little bit, but it's not the worst imposition. But we ought to really be looking very closely at reopening the economy, getting kids back into school in person. And those are things that are far more important than the mask wearing.
Well, also in terms of some postmortem on all of this at some point, again, going back to Dr. Macri's op-ed in the Journal, he does some back of the envelope math with respect to some things we sort of now know, or the numbers seem to indicate about natural immunity, plus where we are with, one in six Americans being vaccinated at this juncture. And he suggests that we have a population fatality rate of 0.15%, which is approximately the seasonal flu. And so, shouldn't there be some difficult questions asked about all the destruction that was wrought, and particularly when you have light touch states like Florida outperforming lockdown states like New York and Illinois? Shouldn't there be some questions about what exactly it was that the new policies that were pursued, the lockdowns, what exactly they produced and what exactly they caused?
I've written for months now that the fatality rate, when you consider the true number of infections, not the sort of phony confirmed numbers. In other words, what people don't understand and what's broadcast by the media constantly are the number of confirmed cases. Those are the cases that where people have actually gone in, gotten tested, and the test is positive. But not everyone gets tested. And what's been clear for a very long time now is that most cases of COVID are either asymptomatic or the symptoms are relatively benign, so that people don't even go to get tested. So that's where we come up with the realization that far more people have actually been infected with the virus, but then are have had confirmed cases. So we've known for a long time that that's the situation. We've known for a long time that the true fatality rate is a lot lower than what has been broadcast based on the confirmed cases. So, whether or not these severe measures were necessary is a very important question. And again, as I say, I've written for a very long time that these lockdown measures, stay shelter in place measures, the closing all the businesses measures are extremely destructive, and they have their own health effects, which probably in many situations outweigh the effects of COVID directly.
Dr. Zimberg, let's move to New York and Governor Andrew Cuomo's and DOJ FBI investigating his nursing home debacle. First, we thought 9,000 died. Now it turns out 15,000 people died in nursing homes. What do you understand happened there?
And before you answer that question, because I know you've written about him and you're there at Mount Sinai, I want you to react to what he had to say on Friday about what the real issue is and what he's going to do, the corrective action that Governor Cuomo is going to take.
We did not aggressively enough take on the misinformation that caused people pain. And it caused pain for grieving families. And that's what I regret. I'm not going to make that mistake again. If you're lying to the people of the state of New York, I'm going to call it out. If you are lying in a report, I'm going to call it out. If you're lying in a newspaper because you have your own partisan agenda, I'm going to call it out. I said to the people of the state of New York when I was first elected, I'm here to fight for you. That's my job. I was elected attorney general. I said, I will represent you. I will fight for you. And I will fight as hard as I can for you. Fighting for the people of New York is fighting for the truth for New Yorkers. I'm not going to let New Yorkers be lied to.
It was a communication problem, and he's declared a war on lying, and so that's going to resolve what occurred.
Well, I think if he wants to look for sources of misinformation that misled the public, I think he ought to look in the mirror. You know, for this past year, he has been lauded by the press for his response to the COVID pandemic. He's written about it in a book, what a star he is. He's gotten an Emmy for providing, quote-unquote, reliable information to the public via TV. But the fact of the matter is that the governor and his associates made a series of disastrous policy mistakes. And Governor Cuomo is known as being a micromanager. Nothing happens in that administration without him overseeing it and without his approval. And now the cover's been blown on a prolonged and concerted effort by his administration to cover up the worst of those mistakes. And that's the March 25th directive by his Department of Health that compelled nursing facilities to admit COVID-19 patients from hospitals, regardless of whether they had a confirmed or suspected active COVID infection.
Why did he do that? I mean, what? Why?
Well, you know, the explanation at the time was that they were concerned about preserving hospital beds. They were worried that the hospitals would be overwhelmed and they needed to get people who were medically stable out of the hospital. But you don't do that by putting them into a closed living arrangement that has the most vulnerable people to COVID. And that's the elderly and the infirm. Those are the people who live in nursing facilities and adult care facilities. And he forced those facilities to take those patients back. And he forbade them from testing whether they still had an active COVID infection. It's right there in the directive. The language is really unequivocal that they cannot test and they must comply. They cannot refuse those folks admission.
There's something else.
And he went ahead on a cover-up, and they directed the state to not count people who had been nursing home patients who were so sick that they got transferred to a hospital and died in the hospital. Those somehow weren't counted. And everyone saw that, the journalists, academics, other politicians. But for 6 months, they stonewalled and would not provide information on how many of those people had been admitted back from the hospitals, and they would not provide information, the true information on how many nursing home facility patients had died.
There's something else, too, that a hospital bed shortage was self-inflicted, and this is a way underreported aspect of the story. In point of fact, some 20 hospitals have closed in New York City alone over the last two decades, most in low-income communities. Statewide, the number of hospital beds per capita fallen in New York by 13% since 2010, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, and it was because of the state's mismanagement of the Medicaid program, which occurred not exclusively under Cuomo, but including under Cuomo.
Yeah, but in addition, what he has failed to acknowledge is that this state had other options. They had opened the Javits Convention Center as a medical facility. It was underused. There were many, many empty beds. They had the Navy ship Comfort tied up in New York Harbor. It went virtually unused. All those beds were unused. They could have taken in those patients from the hospitals instead of putting them back in the nursing homes. But, you know, it was like pouring fuel on a forest fire.
He is Dr. Joel Zinberg, senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute in D.C., associate clinical professor of surgery at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, and is somebody who's been one of the reasonable and some semi-lonely voices in the wilderness over the last year. Dr. Zinberg, we appreciate it.
Sure thing, anytime.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Time now for another reason why Dan Proft is single.
Yeah, this is a quick one here. A 31-year-old Danish tutor from Copenhagen, a Scandinavian neighbor of yours, Amy.
Yes.
Eldina Jagenjack.
Of course.
Fed up with what she says are ridiculous beauty standards imposed on women, particularly when it comes to hair removal. So she is now sporting an Anthony Davis quality unibrow and
a beard.
No,
a mustache?
She's got like a little one of those, like
the chin on the hair,
like a mustache that like a 14-year-old would have. You know, one of those faint mustaches.
Oh, those are the ugliest ones of them all.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Before I let my unibrow grow out, I did feel like there were extremely limited options to how women were supposed to look. If a man doesn't shave and doesn't pluck his eyebrows, no one notices or comments, and it's nothing out of the ordinary. So what's good for men is good for women when it comes to hairiness.
I'm looking at a picture of her right now. I think you two would make a lovely couple.
Right. The ugliness of identitarian feminism. Another reason why Dan Proft is single.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Get your tickets for Biden, the first 100 days on March 20th. Tickets are on sale now at 560theanswer.com/Biden.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and we need to examine what happened in Texas because the left is using the power outage there and the ensuing devastation to so many families, which, you know, it persists. Thankfully, the weather has broken and the power is being restored, but you still have two-thirds of the population under a boil water order. So what happened? Was it, as the left says, a failure of free market capitalism, a failure of reliance on the federal government? Here is what Governor Greg Abbott had to say, including about the electric rate authority that was charged with maintaining the power grid in Texas at a presser he had end of last week.
They said 5 days before the winter storm hit, the ERCOT CEO assured ERCOT, and I quote, "We're ready for the cold temperatures coming our way." He said that ERCOT had issued a notice to power plants to ensure that they were winterized properly. And ERCOT's annual winter assessment, which is designed to ensure that the state is prepared, assured the public that there would be enough power to meet peak demand this winter. ERCOT failed on each of these measures that they said they had undertaken. Texans deserve answers about why these shortfalls occurred and how they're going to be corrected, and Texans will get those answers. I'm taking responsibility for the current status of ERCOT.
So that's Abbott, who proposed a package of reforms to the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, which manages the power grid. But what exactly happened? Was it market externalities that created moral hazards with respect to energy investment in the state of Texas? Well, that's in part what Jason Isaac, who gave an extended interview over at the Epoch Times, which was very good. I'll post the whole thing, but some important snippets from it. Jason Isaac is the energy point person for the Texas Public Policy Foundation. He had this to say, and this is coming from somebody who wrote about 8-10 months ago, the vulnerability the Texas power grid had to an unforeseen weather event. He was thinking it would be extreme heat during the summer, not extreme cold during February, but his point notwithstanding.
Sure, this is a culmination of bad policy that's been put in place that's been distorting the market for decades now, not only in Texas at the federal level, but has propped up one form of energy production that's unreliable over another form of energy production that is reliable. And market distorting policies at the federal level have propped up wind and solar that are intermittent, variable, unreliable sources that only provide electricity when the wind is blowing or the sun is shining. And they have competed so much that they've outpaced and outplaced and displaced natural gas, clean coal, and nuclear generation. We've seen a net loss of thermal generation, which is electricity from natural gas, coal, or nuclear, over the last 5 years, a decrease when our population, our economy have not gone in that direction. They've actually increased significantly. But we have seen a massive increase in wind and solar generation over the last 4 years that just didn't come through. incredibly small percentage of electricity being generated on Valentine's night and early President's Day morning, Monday morning, from these unreliable sources. So that is really the precipice of how this began. It just wasn't a one-time issue. We've known this was coming for years at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. I actually wrote about this and warning about this 8 months ago.
And it turns out that of the 45 gigawatts of capacity that shut down during the storm or shut down by the storm, 40% of that, 18 gigawatts, were from wind and solar. So it's not the whole story, but it's a significant part. Also, just getting Jason Isaacs' response to the criticism that, well, Texas is, you know, independent streak and its lack of connection to the federal grid is also a mistake. This is what happens when you want to go it alone rather than lean on the federal government.
No, we're an independent state, and we like our Texas independence. And the last thing we want to do is have our grid controlled by any kind of federal regulatory agency or the federal government. We like having it independent. We like managing it, but we want to see the elimination of these market distorting policies that pick one type of winner over another type of reliable source of electricity generation. So we're already connected to the Eastern grid and the Western grid and even Mexico. So we do power sharing and power trading with those interchanges to the east, to the west, and to Mexico from time to time. Sometimes we're importing electricity from Mexico, and other times we're exporting it. It seems to work. The setup is good. The management was poor, and market distorting policies via subsidies have really hampered us. And this has been a long time coming.
And don't you think, I mean, the media wants Texas to look bad in hopes of flipping them blue, you know, to become a Democratic state?
For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Robert Bryce, visiting fellow at the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. He's the host of the Power Hungry podcast and author of A Question of Power, Electricity and the Wealth of Nations. He's also the writer of the documentary Juice, How Electricity Explains the World. Robert Bryce, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Glad to be with you, Dan.
What is your assessment of what fellow egghead Jason Isaac had to say about what happened in Texas?
Egghead? I thought you were going to say handsome guy, smart guy.
Well, you know, I say that with all love, yes.
Okay. Well, I think that some of the things that Jason is saying are absolutely right, and that I think that the key issues here are that the structure in ERCOT didn't favor resilience and surplus. It actually favored shortages. That it was an energy only market, and the renewable industry loved that because they didn't have to provide in the market structure. They didn't have to provide power when power was dear. In other words, they didn't have to deliver kilowatts, megawatts, gigawatts when demand was high. They could provide that when demand was low. So by being in that kind of market, it skewed the market toward renewables in a way, and the structure of the market itself did. But I want to back out for just a minute, because I think the broader story, and it's the piece that I wrote in Forbes a week ago, and I published it almost – well, exactly 7 days ago, right after we lost power in our house here in central Austin. We were without electricity for 45 very cold hours. But that this move to electrify everything is the linchpin of the climate activists' plan for the future. They want to put all of our transportation load, industrial load, residential load, everything onto the electric grid. Well, it's a recipe for disaster. It's putting all of our energy eggs in one basket, and we've already seen how fragile the electric grid is. So the idea that we should quit using natural gas directly in our homes and rely solely on electricity, that is, I think, the biggest issue at hand and one that we ignore at our peril.
Well, do you know when the last time the electric grid was updated?
Well, the electric grid, I mean, that's one of the interesting things about this is the idea, the grid. Well, yeah. The electric grid itself is an incredibly complex machine. This is the largest machine in the world. We have, in the United States, 3,000 different electricity providers. We have the publicly owned power utilities. We have the cooperatives. We have the investor-owned utilities like Exelon. Making all of this work together is an incredibly delicate dance, and the grid is always being upgraded. When I plug in my computer, I'm connecting to the grid. So all this machinery, this is the mother network, and that's the other key point here, is that this is the network upon which all modern networks depend. And we tamper with and ignore its fragility and its resilience at our peril.
And the media talking about this is like the media talking about guns. I mean, they don't even bother to understand what they're trying to communicate. So you hear people conflating, you know, natural gas froze. And it's not natural gas. No, natural gas didn't freeze. The gas didn't freeze, but some of the equipment that delivers the natural gas did. And so there were also questions about the necessary maintenance and winterization efforts in Texas with respect to its grid.
Well, that's absolutely true. And one of the other things that is that, and two points. One is natural gas now in the United States is providing about 40% of all the electricity that's generated in this country. It was the hero during the Texas blackouts. Without natural gas, the U.S. grid would have the Texas grid would have collapsed. So it's time for us to understand that natural gas is a critical fuel for the United States. There's just no getting around it. A lot of people like to hate hydrocarbons, and now that you know they're full-on efforts to ban natural gas. But the idea that we should shut down our entire natural gas grid—it's the envy of the world, and it's a critical fuel and needs to be understood as a piece of our critical infrastructure. One other point that I think deserves a lot of attention as well. And you're in Chicago, correct? You're in Illinois,
right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, Exelon is getting ready to close two nuclear reactors in Illinois. The lesson from the big takeaway lesson, perhaps more than any other from Texas and the Texas blackouts, is do not close your nuclear plants. They are critical to the stability of your electric grid. We can talk about what forms of generation performed well, which ones didn't. There's no doubt that's clear that the nuclear reactors, four of them in Texas, at Comanche Peak and in South Texas Project, produced and performed better than any other form of generation. Without those, Texas grid would have really been in the hurt locker.
Well, so, this is the idea of redundancy, which was lacking.
Well, I think it's redundancy, but I prefer to use the word resilience.
And yeah, okay.
So much of the discussion in Texas and elsewhere has been on the focus and the spending and the transmission capacity has been focused on decarbonization of the grid and not nearly enough on resilience. And the reality is, Texas came very close to a complete system blackout. I mean, there were moments there, it's been reported a couple different places, that the system, the entire Texas grid, was within a few minutes of shutting down entirely. Well, right. That would have been catastrophic failure. And so all this focus on decarbonization, what about resilience? This is the most important network in society, and it's just been kind of accepted, oh, it's going to work out. Well, no, it needs attention and careful attention.
And then what about those who signed up for the variable rate utility plans who got electric bills of $16,000?
I know, and some of this, again, is, Amy, it's a great point, and this has been this whole line of, oh, well, wind and solar are cheaper. Well, until they aren't, and that's what we've seen, is that during these periods of extreme weather, the prices skyrocket, and that was a function of the market in which all these electricity producers were participating. They were rewarding scarcity, which seems like the absolute wrong approach if you want abundant, reliable electricity.
Right. And of course, one of the great ironies is that the Biden team comes to the rescue with what? Diesel generators. So they come to the rescue with oil. It's hard because it requires people to follow a continuum of look at decisions that were made and then ultimately the consequences in a moment. But this is what you're getting at and what Jason Isaac was getting at. You create these externalities. You set up perverse incentives. So, for example, the subsidies that were allowing wind and solar operators to essentially pay providers to use their power sources as compared to natural gas, and you change the distribution that you're relying on in terms of power source, and then when you have a catastrophic weather event, you could have something catastrophic with the power grid. But sort of those connections to policies at the front end and consequences at the back end are sometimes hard to convey.
Well, I think that's right, Dan. And, you know, the oldest maxim in politics is follow the money. Okay, well, follow the money. Where did the money, where did all the investment in Texas go? And I think this follows somewhat on Jason Isaac's point and also some points that Alex Epstein has made, as well as Meredith Angwin, who's the author of a terrific book called Shorting the Grid, who really was prescient in looking at some of these issues. Follow the money. Where was all the investment in Texas? Well, it was in, one was the CREZ lines, these competitive resource enterprise zones. All Texas ratepayers paid to pay for the cost of those transmission lines, which were finished, I guess, in 2013, at a cost of many billions of dollars. Well, so ratepayers are effectively directly subsidizing transmission for this one form of energy. Well, but what did we get in return? It wasn't reliable power, which is the key here.
Robert Bryce, visiting fellow at the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity, host of the Power Hungry podcast, author of A Question of Power, Electricity and the Wealth of Nations, and writer of the documentary Juice, How Electricity Explains the World. Robert, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks a million, Dan.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, and I love this story. This is what happens when a dutiful corporate a partner in pushing state agitprop runs into its bottom line. The airline's Cathay Pacific Airways is exempting wealthy passengers from wearing masks on their flights. The Hong Kong-based airline are creating a waiver on wearing a mask for first class and business class travelers who are reclined in their seats. The new policy does not apply for economy seating, as they must keep their masks on at all times.
Oh, my God.
Because if you recline, the COVID can't get you. If
right.
you sit upright, the COVID can get you on a flight.
This and is, it's because they have to pay more, right? To sit up
of course. It's here's, their bottom
here's a,
line.
Here's a perk.
It's their bottom line, and it also, again, speaks to what we what is really the takeaway from these incidents of hypocrisy, the Gavin Newsoms and the Lightfoots and the de Blasios. Forget the hypocrisy, what it indicates about what they really think, what they really think about the mortal threat that they prattle on about trying to induce fear.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.